Chapter 2, War Years in Reading. When the inevitable happened and war was declared in 1939, we all knew that our lives would be drastically altered. I had already registered as a conscientious objector in Northampton and now awaited my call-up. In this chapter I will try to give some remembered picture of what it was like to be a conscientious objector in a country dedicated to total war. What were the emotions and experiences encountered, the inglorious adventures, the pathos and the humour of our unpopular situation? I will do this not from the mumbling nostalgia of talkative old age, but because so many of our younger and even middle-aged brethren have never experienced it and need to be prepared against its recurrence. There was nothing pleasing to the flesh in being a conscientious objector, at least there was not to me. I hated it. It was something to be endured for Christ's sake, and the one who has, like most humans, a preference for being well thought of rather than despised. When other young men are losing their lives in most appalling conditions and doing deeds of unbelievable heroism, not counting the cost, there is nothing pleasing to the natural man or flattering to his dignity in refusing to join in. Only the need to obey God rather than men can persuade otherwise. It was in May 1940 that my call-up came. I was still working as an insurance agent for the Prudential Assurance Company, but my heart was not in it any longer. Ever since the war began, in the previous September, life had become more and more difficult, and clients on whom I had to make my weekly calls were not sympathetic to my position as a Christadelphian. I recall one lady with whom I had previously had some conversation on the Bible and who seemed to be quite impressed. When I informed her that I would be a conscientious objector and would have to leave my job, cried out at me, "You coward, you coward! To think that I thought you were a nice young man. There's my son out there fighting for you, and you refuse to do your bit." And although I begged her to tell him to come back home if he was doing it for me, it made no difference. I was a coward in her eyes, and it hurt so that I feel the sting to this day. There was, therefore, some sense of relief, tinged with apprehension, when my call came to present myself before the Conscientious Objectors Tribunal to be held in Reading. Brother Harry Taylor was recording brother of the Ecclesia and a good friend, so he went with me to the tribunal. For the benefit of those who have not had this experience, so they may have it to come, it may be as well to describe what happened. The tribunal was composed of about four gentlemen with a judge as president. In this case it was a Judge Drucker. I still remember the name, though I'm not sure of the spelling. And the only local bigwig I can remember sitting with him was a military man named Major Palmer, a member of the Reading biscuit firm of Huntley and Palmer's. Brother Fred Mitchell had warned me, as he was a member of the Military Service Committee and familiar with tribunal thinking, that I might have a rough ride, for he believed that Reading Tribunal was about to have a crackdown on Christadelphians who had been getting away with it recently too lightly. So my morale was a little low as my turn came to face the tribunal. In fact, however, the judge dealt very kindly with me. I had to answer a few questions about my membership of the Christadelphian body, and Brother Taylor told them that I was one of the Ecclesia's principal preachers. In fact, he appealed for total exemption for me on the ground that I was an unpaid minister of the gospel, though I had not desired this. The judge asked me if I would be willing to do work on the land, and on my replying in the affirmative, he made this a condition of my exemption, adding in quite a friendly tone that he hoped I would be successful in getting the work near Reading so that you can continue your work with the Christadelphians. which we all thought was extraordinarily generous of him. The local newspaper came out with a report on my case with a headline, Ministerial Work for the Christadelphians, which only served to exacerbate the feelings of some of my neighbours and make life even more difficult. One lady two doors away refused to let me collect her weekly insurance money, saying that they did not deal with conscientious objectors. Such rebuffs were very common, and rather humiliating to the flesh, so they did some good. By a strange twist of circumstances, this particular lady's husband, who was a police officer and thereby exempt from military service himself, had to come and see me on behalf of the chief constable of Reading, who was his boss, in connection with a letter I had written about firewatch duties when they were introduced some year or two later. So he had to deal with me after all, and in fact was quite amicable in the interview. It is a strange fact that women, the gentler sex, are often more hostile over military matters than men, and more contemptuous of conscientious objectors. It was, after all, the women and girls who went around giving out white feathers to men in mufti in the First World War. Having now been directed by the tribunal to work on the land, the first thing was to inform my employers, and I had to see my regional manager to explain the position. He was not sympathetic and made it clear that my career with the Prue was over for good, as their policy was not to keep jobs open for conscientious objectors. As any future career prospects seemed far off and unimportant anyway, this didn't worry me, and the only thing that mattered was to get the required work on a farm, hopefully near home. It so happened that a brother Headley Trotman in the Reading meeting had a business in the town selling fruit and vegetables, and through his good offices I obtained work in a market garden and fruit farm about 3 miles out of the town and accessible from my home. It was owned by an old gentleman named Sinclair Reeves, who was not prejudiced against conscientious objectors, and who later treated me with great consideration, especially when he found that I was honest and had a head for business and was able to make a lot of money for him. But of course I was not to know that at the time of going for my first day's work, and was filled with apprehension as I cycled out to face the unknown, convinced that if not bonds and imprisonment awaited me, there was every possibility of physical violence and personal indignity. I knew a brethren who had so suffered in the Great War, being thrown into the village pond and things of this kind, and felt sure that I would suffer the same fate. It is a curious fact of human nature that the worst suffering experienced is often simply in the apprehension of it, the reality often turning out to be less than the anticipation. It was so in my case. But I recall now, after all these years, that on my first ride out to the farm, I suddenly realized that my shining new boots bought for the occasion would give me away as a novice, and I dismounted my bicycle to rub them in the grass verge on the country road to try to take off their newness, as if my boots alone would reveal my ineptitude as a farm worker. One of the lessons learned by those who left sedentary town jobs to go out to work on farms was that when it comes to the skills of agricultural employment, hoeing, hedging, ditching, ploughing, etc., it is the townie who is the greenhorn, and a healthy respect is engendered for the genuine skills of the countryside. I worked for this employer for the whole period of the war, and in 1946, when my release came, my old boss begged me to stay with him, promising with tears in his eyes that he would make it worth my while to do so. So greatly had the Lord helped me. But I had already made plans to go back to Northampton and work for my brother, so had to decline. All this was hid in the future, of course, when I faced the unknown on that June morning in 1940. And though this is not an autobiography, I shall not weary the reader with a detailed account of all that happened to me in those 6 years. Yet I feel it would be helpful to younger members to give some idea of the reaction one gets from having to take up work of this kind in such an adverse climate of thought and in a completely alien environment. Generally speaking, the first reaction of the other workers is curious as much as hostile. They probably have not met a conscientious objector before, and it would be unfair to expect them to understand the religious reasons for refusing to fight. They have generally been led to believe that all COs are cowards who funk the dangers of service in the armed forces. But after a time they come to accept you for what you are, and in my case, though not in all cases, the anticipated physical violence did not materialise. There was a lot of chaffing, of course, and some slighting remarks as we sat in the shed eating our bread and cheese. But one has to expect that, and in time it dies down and you are accepted as not too bad a chap look. It is not pleasant to see reports from newspapers pinned up surreptitiously on the shed wall, saying that all conscientious objectors should be shot. But as the fellow responsible was not man enough to say it to one's face, it mattered little. The work was hard and physical, and I was not used to this kind of dirty work, but I got used to it in time, and became one of the strongest men on the farm before I left, largely because my boss later put me in charge of the marketing, which meant that I had to harness up my horse and cart and go round the farm and the orchards loading up the sacks of vegetables and boxes of fruit to take back to the farmyard to weigh up and prepare for sending into town. This continual lifting of heavy loads developed my muscles so that I became quite tough and strong, which does help to deter would-be attackers. So, when one of the men informed me in front of a gang of others that so-and-so says he's going to punch your nose, I was able to reply, "You go and tell him to come and try," and heard no more about it. Though what I would have done as a good conscientious objector had he taken me up, I do not know. There is no doubt that a sense of humour is a great help in such circumstances, and I found no difficulty in being able to laugh at their jokes at my expense. "There'll soon be nobody left here except Len and the women," was a crack I recall when more farm workers were being called up. On another occasion they were all discussing what they were going to do that night. One was going to the Bull and Bush, another to a darts match at another public house. "And Len's going to Christie's," says one. "Christie's? Who the hell's Christie's?" says another. "What?" says the first. "Don't you know Christie's? Christadelphians, of course." There was no malice in it, and I sometimes thought there was a certain respect in some of their uncouth ribaldry. Their realization that the Christadelphians was the centre of my off-duty activities serves to remind that ecclesial life was going on all this time and indeed was prospering. Reading had become an important overspill to London, and many government and commercial offices had been evacuated there, away from the massive bombing attacks, which were reducing much of the capital to rubble. So the Reading ecclesia grew in numbers, and at one time topped the 100 mark. We had some lively brethren and a good spread of ability in the meeting, with a lot of activity going on all the time. Our home became a rendezvous for many of the young people, and a good youth group was formed. We were active in preaching work, including outdoor preaching by the riverside, and ran extra meetings such as an open Bible study group, to which all interested in the Bible were invited to come and discuss the scriptures on equal terms, a forerunner of present-day Bible reading groups, perhaps. We've got quite a lot of people there, mostly already committed to their own viewpoints, such as Jehovah's Witnesses. And the exercise was certainly beneficial to us all in examining other people's beliefs. I recall one of the JWs being a particularly pleasant man who had built them a meeting place in the grounds of his own home. He was quite a wealthy man, and asked me one day if I would visit him at home, as he had been impressed with our discussions and wanted to put a proposition to me. It turned out that he had the idea that as we had so much in common, and both communities were outcast from the friendship of the world, we should unite our forces and join into one. It was a sincere offer, and superficially attractive, but came to nothing when I suggested that we went away and each formulated a list of what we should consider essential teachings on which to form an alliance. It appeared that they did not have any clear definition, and would be prepared to welcome anybody who was prepared to witness along their traditional lines. We remained good friends, but never became brethren. It is curious how many brethren and sisters look back on those war years as being the heyday of ecclesial life. In some ways, they will tell you, things have never been the same since. Now the answer to those who complain that things aren't what they used to be is that they never were. I would go even further and say they never should be. If a body is growing, it will be changing, and instead of always looking back, we should be going on, increasing in the knowledge of God. Nevertheless, there is no doubt that ostracism by the world is good for Christian fellowship, and ecclesial life is benefited by opposition. And even the mild persecution caused by our conscientious objection to participation in the war effort led to a tightening of the bonds within the ecclesias and a more dedicated witness. When the world doesn't want us and casts us out with opprobrium, we are drawn closer together and find our interest and activities only in the company of believers, and this tends to the strengthening of the whole body. In the easier times of peace and the affluent society which followed, we lost, at least to some extent, the sense of belonging to a despised and unpopular community, and the world does not then seem so unattractive. Perhaps we shall need another period of persecution, even more than the active dislike of those war years, which scarcely deserved the title of persecution, to sort us out again and make us more like a people prepared for the Lord. Like many other ecclesias, we had in the meeting at Reading a number of brethren and some sisters working on the land as a result of tribunal decisions, and there were the inevitable stories and in-jokes about their experiences. I remember a dear young brother who died soon after the war ended, whom many will have known at the time, for he was becoming a popular speaker. His name was Roy Cook. Roy was on a farm, like many of us, never having done anything like it before, and he found the job of hoeing nearly broke his back. He used to say, "It says in Ecclesiastes that God made man upright, but he sought out many inventions. One of these was the hoe, since when man has been bent double." As one who had the same experience early on, I knew just what he meant. My first summer on the land was very dry and hot, and faced with long, long rows to be hoed, seeming to stretch into the interminable distance, I used to take a bottle of water and keep moving in about four rows along, so that I had to go up and down twice before I allowed myself a swig of the refreshing water. Only thus could I keep going in the heat. I know other brethren who did the same. It made one remember the water of life which Jesus gives, which if a man drink, he shall never thirst. Another young brother told the story of his first day on a stock farm. His employer was not sympathetic to conscientious objectors, and obviously intended to give him a baptism of fire by ordering him to clean out the pen in which his biggest and fiercest bull was kept. The young man was terrified, never having encountered such a beast at close quarters before. He was not without ingenuity. His employer having left him to go into breakfast, he got a bucket of oats and a short, strong stick. By holding the oats outside the pen, he enticed the snorting bull to put his ring nose through the fencing. In a flash, he then stuck the stick through the ring, and thus made fast the creature, while he went in to do the cleaning out. This done, he released the bull, and his employer coming back later, was astonished to find he had done the job without fear or harm. There were many such tales, humorous and serious, to be exchanged when we met, and I am sure that others will be able to recount their own. In 1941, the government introduced an order which required the compulsory enrolment of all able-bodied citizens for fire-watching duties. The war on Britain was now at its height, with ceaseless bombing raids from France and Germany, and it was considered necessary that the civilian population should be enlisted to take turns in detecting and combating the resultant fires which were gutting large areas in the cities and towns. It meant that anybody could be enrolled for this duty, either in their place of work or in the area in which they lived. Now, there was in existence in the Christadelphian Brotherhood a small group of brethren calling themselves the Civil Defence Committee. The self-appointed function of this committee was to send out circulars in opposition to the council of the properly constituted Military Service Committee, especially in regard to anything to do with being involved in any form of civil defence work. No doubt they were very sincere in what they felt it their duty to do, but it did mean that there were two voices giving different advice, and inevitably led to some confusion, and occasionally acrimony, as dissident voices always do. There must always be a conflict of loyalties in the mind of somebody holding a point of view opposed to what might be called the traditional or establishment view. Should he keep quiet for the sake of peace and unanimity, or ought he to speak out to warn his brethren of the danger in which he sees or imagines them to be? The Civil Defence Committee took the latter view, believing that any form of involvement in the war would prejudice our whole position, even if it was only in firewatch duties. They were prepared to go to prison rather than accept such duties, though the requirement was only for a limited number of hours each week. At least one member of their committee did, in fact, serve a term of imprisonment over it. The majority view was that there could be nothing wrong in assisting to save life and property by acting as lookouts during the air raids, and that the firewatch duties were a case in which we should be prepared to obey the magistrates, since they were not of a military nature. I found myself supporting the Military Service Committee viewpoint, and still do. Like the majority of members, I found it difficult to see what could possibly be wrong in such a simple service of goodwill to our fellows in trying to mitigate the loss of life and property which the bombings were causing. But as a safeguard, when I received my enrolment notice from the Chief Constable, I wrote a letter explaining that I was a registered conscientious objector and would be willing to undertake fire-watching duties as a public service, so long as it was understood that I would not be prepared to come under military orders, or do anything which prejudiced my position as a Christadelphian objector to all forms of military service. It was as a result of this letter that my neighbour, who was a police officer, was sent to interview me, and as a consequence I received the following letter on the 29th of January 1942, which I have kept for reference. Fire Guard Office, Cranberry Road, Reading. Dear Sir, your letter of the 20th instant, addressed to the Chief Constable, has been forwarded to this office. The orders you receive as a fire guard will relate only to the duties required of you in the detecting or combating of fires, and we cannot foresee any orders arising that would be prejudicial to you as a conscientious objector to any form of military service. Yours faithfully, so-and-so staff officer. I have quoted this correspondence not because I think it was particularly clever of me to think of it, for I am sure many others must have done something similar, but to emphasise what I feel to be a very important principle in all such matters, that is, to make your position clear from the beginning. If this is done, the authorities will generally be quite able to understand what your difficulties are, and if you get it in writing such as this, you have something to which you can refer should problems arise later. It meant in my case that I could undertake these duties, which I felt to be utterly reasonable, without the fear which the Civil Defence Committee were urging, that it would be the thin end of the wedge and would inevitably lead to increasing involvement. So I did my bit of fire watching. In the event it only meant doing one night a week on an uncomfortable camp bed in premises in the centre of Reading, and taking a turn sleeping on a pile of sacks of corn in a shed on the farm. No great hardship, when so many of my generation were being shot from the skies or dying in the oceans in unimaginable horrors. It always turns my stomach a little when references are made to suffering for conscience' sake, for even if a brother should have to put up with some unpleasantness or inconvenience, it is little compared with the dreadful pains and sufferings, mutilation and death, from which his religion has spared him. We did not have a great deal of destruction from enemy aircraft in Reading, the worst incident being a stick of bombs on a large British restaurant in the town, which killed over 50 people. These restaurants had been established by order of the government to ensure that civilian workers were able to get a hot meal at reasonable prices, and the restaurant had been full when the bombs fell. There were other incidents, but this was the worst we had. It was, I remember, a grey misty day, and one of the German aircraft must have lost his way, and came over our farm in the late afternoon, flying so low that as he passed across the sheds where I was working, I ran out to see what was happening, for it seemed that he must hit the trees opposite. And as he flew past, I could clearly see his head in the cockpit and the German cross on the side of the plane. He could have easily have machine-gunned me as I stood open-mouthed watching him go by, but presumably had more important things on his mind than attacking a farm yokel, and may have been as disconcerted as I. When I got home that night, I heard about the raids on the British restaurant. It was the nearest I got to enemy action. In many other cities and towns, of course, such experiences were normal, for the bombing raids were devastating and incessant. I saw something of them on my frequent speaking visits to places like London, Southampton and Portsmouth. I remember watching a raid on Portsmouth from Brother Fred Soph's home on Portsdown Hill one Saturday evening as the planes came over in waves, dropping incendiary bombs to light up the targets for the heavier stuff following. It was an awesome sight to witness a city going up in flames. I wonder if I was the only speaking brother to give the exhortation in an air raid shelter. It happened like this. I was speaking at the old Tooting Ecclesia in London soon after war broke out. The brethren there met in the cooperative hall, which had an underground air raid shelter. Just before the exhortation was to be given, the air raid siren sounded, and they moved the emblems down to the shelter, to which all then repaired in haste, and so I gave the exhortation there in the bowels of the building. It was like meeting in the catacombs. However, I believe the brethren felt it a little unseemly to scurry down to shelter in this way whilst engaged in the Lord's remembrance, and they never did it again. I also recall speaking at the Croydon Ecclesia when the doodlebugs were falling towards the end of the war in Europe. These were the earliest missiles and Hitler's secret weapon for the final reduction of Britain. You didn't hear anything until they landed with devastating effect, and they fell indiscriminately. I remember watching one go over from the garden of Brother Harold Craddock, with whom I was staying, with the flame shooting out of the back in characteristic fashion. I think he thought I was mad to go out, but coming from an area which had the distinction of being comparatively safe, it was an experience which I did not want to miss. That evening, too, I spoke to the smallest audience they had during the whole wartime. There were 6 present, including speaker and president. And as I was speaking, the blast from falling missiles rocked the building, and doors swung open of their own accord. It was both eerie and exciting. There was an idea prevalent in the Brotherhood early in the war that God's protection would be afforded to his children, and that if we had faith, we should be in some way immune from the effects of the bombing. Brother H. A. Thompson, a well-known brother in the Ealing meeting in London, with a specialised knowledge of archaeology, by the way, actually wrote a hymn called London Night Bombers Overhead, based on Psalm 91, to the effect that the Lord would preserve those who trusted in him. 1,000 shall fall at thy right hand, and 10,000 at thy left, but it shall not come nigh thee, was the implication. But events proved that, in fact, David's dictum was nearer the truth. The sword devoureth one as well as another. For there were not a few casualties among Christadelphians from the bombings. We were all shocked to hear of the sad death of Brother Jim Blackburn in the Coventry Blitz. He was a fine brother, and a speaker of national repute, who was sadly missed, cut off in the prime of life. I remember him particularly because it was he who, when I was a very young man, advised me to get a Young's Analytical Concordance, saying that in his opinion it was the very best help to Bible study. I got one soon after for a 21st birthday present, and have used it ever since, and found he was right. Bless his memory and his good advice. There were others too who were killed when their homes were blasted, and many who lost their homes and their health. I think of Brother Horace Dawes of Southampton, who was injured in an air raid but appeared to recover. Only later did it transpire that the damage done had affected his brain in some way, which led to eventual paralysis and death. He was also a very well-known public speaker, who used to thrill me as a youth when he came to Northampton to lecture. He was very forthright and vigorous in speaking, and seemed to me at that time of heroic proportions. Later I got to know him very well as a man, and often stayed at his home when speaking at the Southampton meeting, and though I rather turned against his histrionic style on the platform, I loved him much more as a brother in private. I suppose when we're young, we all tend to enjoy the more flamboyant type of public performance from speakers, but in my case, and no doubt in many others, one grows to prefer reasoned discussion out of the scriptures to the more ejaculatory and condemnatory desk-thumping antics and impressed in callow youth. Nevertheless, it's better to be loved as a brother than admired as a performer, and I loved him as a brother. In my young days in the Christadelphian body, there was probably an excessive veneration paid to well-known speakers. No doubt this was partly due to the fact that there were less of them. Ecclesias were not so well off financially then, and could not afford to pay the travelling expenses of a great number of visiting speakers. And education was not so widespread. We were more of what Dr. Brian Wilton called the artisan classes. Perhaps, too, there was still an innate respect for elders, and a hangover from 19th century hero worship. Whatever the reasons, the fact is that young brethren, and many older too, did regard famous lecturing brethren as something akin to awe. Whether we are better off now in the age of disillusion, I do not know. Certainly it seems to me that well-known speakers are not regarded in the same way that we did. Perhaps that is all to the good for their souls anyway. Whether the young have lost something by it is another matter. Some years ago I was speaking to an audience of young Christadelphians at the Harrogate Youth Conference and mentioned this change in attitudes towards speakers of repute. I told them how, as a young man, I first met Brother Isaac Collier, whose speaking and writing I had always so admired. It was at one of the early Whitsuntide gatherings, and the great man was surrounded by a bevy of brethren and sisters, so I waited my time and edged towards him with trembling, sweaty hands, and my mouth dried up with excitement, so that when I eventually got to him, all I could blunder out was something to the effect that I so enjoyed his writings and just wanted to shake his hand, which was about all I did, for he seemed a little taken aback by my earnestness. At this point in my talk, the young people roared with laughter, totally amused by the description of my youthful encounter. But I pointed out to them that their reaction simply proved my point. They had no idea what I was talking about. They thought it strange and amusing that a young brother should get himself into such a state just because he was meeting somebody called Islip Collier. Poor dears, they had never had the experience, but I still cherish it. Later on, when he came to speak at Reading in the war years, my wife and I had the privilege of entertaining Brother Islip, and what a delight it was. He was a gentle and humble man, who I am sure would have eschewed any thought of being a great man, and rightly so. But was I any the worse for having such a regard for him? And are young people today any better for being on matey Christian name terms with brethren whose labours in the Lord over so many years deserve their respect as well as their love? Paul has a good deal to say about our attitude to elders. For example, 1 Timothy 5, Hebrews 13, etc. And although few older brethren would feel themselves either worthy of or desirous of such a respectful attitude today, I wonder if the young people themselves are not missing out on something of value to their souls. On the occasion in question, when we had Brother Islip in our home, he told us a story about Brother Robert Roberts, who had been his own hero as a young man, and whose home he frequently visited. It appears that at tea the great man flipped some water from his celery over his wife Jane, who felt called upon to excuse what she called these foibles of a great man. "Tut, tut, my dear," said her husband, "we don't meet great men in the Bible," and went on to quote Psalm 62, verse 9, "Surely men of low degree are vanity, and men of high degree are a lie." To which Lady Jane replied, "Ah, yes, but we do read of a great woman." Poor Brother Roberts, the great man was nonplussed, for he could not recall where it was, and had to have it pointed out by his wife in 2 Kings 3 verse 8, in that place was a great woman. Another anecdote of Brother Robert's, revealed on this same occasion by a distinguished visitor, was to do with his practice of doing the readings when they had company. He always read all the chapters himself, no matter how able the other brethren present, said Brother Islip, and he would pause from time to time to expound a point of interest. This seemed an extraordinary impertinence to me, and I felt I needed to find some excuse for it. In Victorian England, I pointed out, Father was like the high priest of the family, so I suppose we should have to forgive him for behaving as a man of his times, though of course it would be considered unthinkable today. Imagine my rebuff, therefore, when our guest replied that he rather liked the idea himself. However, I still think it would be unacceptable behaviour today, and feel sure that a more modest recognition of others' abilities would be better and more Christian, and would have been then. I also wonder at the idea of any of our modern wives referring to their spouses as a great man in company. Most of us would cringe at the thought, and rightly so, but it's not likely to happen. All this has led me away from the remembrance of the war years, and our losses through enemy action, which shattered the naive expectations of some who had been convinced that there would be divine protection for God's people. For myself, the experiences of life have led me to think that the important thing is not so much being spared from danger and suffering, as being helped through it. Has never undertaken to prevent our being involved in the heartache of human life, but he has said he will see us through it if we trust in him. To a large extent, the bombs that fell indiscriminately represented the catastrophes which fall on mankind because of sin, whatever form they take, and saints and sinners share them alike. It is what they do to us that should mark us out. How we stand up to life's blows, and in how much we prove more than conquerors through him that loved us.